Hi, everyone. Welcome to our new podcast called The Dismal Science. My name's William Haynes, and this is...
I'm John Greenwood.
And we've been working together in a secondary school for about 7 years now. And we've decided as a new thing, a new project for us, to actually start up a podcast for A-level economists, but anyone else that's interested in economics, and just to discuss some books, articles, and things that are going on in the UK on national economy. So our first topic we're going to have a look at is John went went to a talk by Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winner, back in
July.
And he's just going to give a bit of an overview of the talk, and we're just going to discuss, think about some questions on the back of that, and we'll have a bit of discussion between the two of us.
I went to talk by Joseph Stiglitz. I've been looking forward to seeing him talk for considerable amount of time, and he was on in London, and I thought, well, I'm going to go along to this. What was very interesting was it was a packed audience, how many people wanted to see Joseph Stiglitz, and it was a talk realistically around his book, The Idea of People, Power and Profit, which I've started to read. It's a very, very decent read, and I would recommend it for anyone wanting to study A-level economics. Because what it does is it puts very clearly the standpoint of where we are in the scheme of things with the evolution of Trump and his policies, and how basically the American economy and the world economy is faring as a result of maybe a shift to the right. What was interesting at the talk was particularly how Stiglitz talked about his upbringing in Gary in Indiana, and how the town had changed from being an industrial town to a town that had seen massive deindustrialization, and how the politics had unfolded. He talked about his friends at school significantly, and how the disagreements that existed within the society existed, and how some people thought that Trump was doing the right thing, becoming more protectionist, and likewise how others disagreed with this viewpoint overall. So there were some decent stuff within that. The good stuff that I like particularly that comes out of his work and in the book is he does criticise the way in which the world has moved towards supply side economics, and it's not just Thatcher and Reagan now. It's a new type of supply side economics where we tax or we use tax cuts more aggressively to really kind of go for the free market approach. And he talks about that, and he's very critical of that. He says that the Trump tax cut will very clearly have very little impact on the American economy in the long run, because there's no new investment going in. It's just giving tax cuts to the rich overall. He's also, again, he flagged this in the talk, he's very critical of the way in which fake news has been portrayed to, you know, news has been questioned by Trump, and attacks on universities and attacks on people who perhaps do offer the truth or do offer some diagnostic opinion on things are being attacked by him, because he wants to set his agenda of free markets and free will on society, and it's upsetting the balance overall. And he's very critical of the wealth that's being created within a society for a minority, and how that wealth is really not trickling down. He questions trickle-down economics significantly. And then likewise, he talks about how technology firms are taking our data, and governments are generally being unaccountable for their actions going forward. So there's some very interesting work that he's doing. What I would say for any economics teachers out there, in the book, in the first chapter, there is a very, very good critique of markets and how the market failure, or how market failure occurs. And I think it's a very good bridge if you're using with your students and you're wanting them to read and engage. There's about two or three pages where he breaks down why markets fundamentally fail and goes through those reasons, and it would be a very good point to, I think, read and discuss with classes.
Absolutely. Between us, John, do you think, why hasn't Joseph Stiglitz, probably has been, I would say, as we've grown up, the standout economist since we've been teaching, why do you think he's not had a greater role in policy? Do you think it because of his views on economics?
Well, he was part of, again, he was part of Clinton's team when he was in the White House, and he is a Democrat by nature. But as we've seen that sort of rise of republicanism and the idea of, you know, the free market ideologue being brought in, he's seen to be part of that world which some would deem to be the old Keynesian world, and not really taken that seriously, or not seen to be the sort of world we wish to sort of move towards today. But I think for policymakers, he has some very, very clear advice about how we need to develop new economies and drive wealth through government intervention. And I think that's being forgotten by many political parties and governments today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I'm sure John would agree, but the way he writes is very factual, isn't it? It's all evidence-based in terms of what he says. So if you're that kind of person that likes reading like pure economics, I will say, more positive economics and maybe normative, his wealth of knowledge is just unbelievable in so many different areas of economics.
And having read his book, I kind of feel that, you know, in the talk he was very sort of charismatic and sort of engaging. In his book he's very clear on the sort of facts, very clear upon putting the ideas out there. But he does sort of discuss things, but you do need at sort of points in time where you read it. It's been a bit of a slow read in some cases because you just need to stop and consider each sort of couple of pages about the points in which he's raising, because there's a lot of ideas flowing out from that, and it really does open one's mind to a bigger process. And I think. Well worth a read, but do factor in some time to do so, because your mind will be buzzing somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely. So carry on the theme of market failure. I read a book called Crashed by Adam Tooze, How a Decade of Financial Crisis Changed the World. Basically, it looks at the causes, the consequences, and the responses to the global financial crisis. It's effectively a whole review of the last 10 years of economics. So if you want to really just get up to date with what's happened in international economics over the last 10 years, I would thoroughly recommend it. It's quite long. It's about 550 pages in length. It takes a lot of time to read it. I read it all over the summer. I really had to dedicate some time to analysing each page. But it really looks at the impact of the crisis on US and Europe, which is what we'd expect, but also actually looking at the impact on China and also on some of the emerging markets as well, which is quite interesting. There's one page which is just excellent, and he must be left-leaning as an economist, and it's quite critical of some of the causes of the financial crisis. But one of the pages, he just really emphasised like the irony in relation to what happened in the financial crisis, that, you know, we, prior to it, the market was the ultimate source of wealth and wealth creation for individuals, and it's ended up and firms, and it's ended up being the case where we've got to a point where the state has had to intervene. They've basically put their hands up and realised that the market is not as efficient as we once believed it would be, and as self-regulating as we once believed it would be. And Martin Wolf's got a lovely quote in it. You know, the day the dream of global free market capitalism died was the day of the financial crisis. So a few questions I just want to discuss on the back of that. I just thought, John, like, you know, did we make the most of the opportunity to change the economic paradigm and address the failures of the free market when the global financial crisis hit? Or have we missed that opportunity a little bit?
I think one of the things that we can look back at in terms of the financial crisis, and I think a lot of people may see this, I think that we've seen the idea of before the financial crash, it was caused by a lack of regulation. But I think that what we've spent time after the financial crash is creating regulations to regulate banks. The question is, have we gone about that in an effective way? And have we got those balances correct? Have we tightened up on the actions of banks so these financial crashes can't happen again in the future? Are we regulating enough? Is there more regulation needed? Have we got a fine balance on that? And I think the regulators, we've seen the FSA involved in this. We've seen governments trying to promote more laws upon what banks can do and what they can't do. But are we moving in the right direction? Because I think part of the issue is that banks, as we know, will always come up with new products that are unrelated as well as we go forward. What do you think?
I think we probably missed a bit of an opportunity. And the problem we faced was that the banks got us into this crisis, but they were also the means of getting us out of it, effectively. Like we had moved to an economy that was so specialised and so reliant on the financial sector that as much as it went down, we knew that the pace of the growth, considering how hard the financial crisis had been hit, considering the pace of growth that they could have gained in the years after the crisis to get us out of it, they probably didn't regulate the markets as much. But it's a case, like, I do look at it and think, you know, do they, if you don't allow them to fail, do they learn from their mistakes? You know, it's a bit like a student in a class. The minute they fail and you're propping them up and supporting them, you know, are they actually learning how to fail? And I just feel we probably didn't allow these banks to fail. There was a bit in about RBS saying the year following that, when they were part nationalised and bailed out, that the millions of pounds that were giving us bankers bonuses following that, I mean, there should have been some regulation to say, you know, this, for the years after that, we are using taxpayers' money. We should have a say, as I think, as taxpayers, as to how that money gets used. I agree with bailing them out, but there should be really tight regulations with the money that they used.
What was interesting was that this was a question on the theme, paper two in unit four, and lots of students successfully talked about the idea of moral hazard on that paper, and they talked about the idea that, you know, should we realistically allow banks to fail? I think the question comes to mind is, in the US they allowed Lehman to fail, and did that send out a message to others that actually they weren't just going to be bailed out, whereas in the UK we didn't let anybody fail. And we again bailed them out, and has that created some degree of complacency and ex inefficiency that's left within the system? And that's a question. You know, should we have really allowed these banks to fail? You know, if we want a purely market economy, it is about the survival of the fittest, and the fittest will survive if they play by the rules of the game and actually behave in a fit and honourable way.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think the government had the money to ensure the deposit, like the deposit. They could have, you know, it wouldn't have meant us. They could have still, in a way, bailed out the banks, make sure the deposit, like the people get their money back, but just allowed that those banks potentially to fail following that. And I think there was the money to do that. But I just feel we probably missed a huge opportunity, and we're still, you know, 10 years down the line, and looking back at it and saying, well, actually, nothing's really changed from the crisis. Like, the financial sector now is bigger than it's ever been, and we've just become even more unbalanced as a result of the financial crisis. Like, if that is I don't see that being any different when I look at Ford in Bridgend in South Wales being closed down. The government aren't willing to step in that situation. Why aren't they not willing to bail out and support those, you know, manufacturing, but they're happy to step in and support the financial sector? For me, you know, it's no different. And I don't think they would have done it for any other industry.
No, I agree. I think, again, we also look at sort of, and again, for the students listening to this, you know, if you haven't already watched The Big Short, you know, it's a film that you must watch. I do apologise for the language that's used in it, but very clearly...
And some of the scenes, yeah.
But clearly, what I will say is that it does raise a very good point at the end, that actually a lot of people, well, not knowing, did it raise a good point at the end, but it talks about the fact that some people got rich on the banking crisis, and then the tools that brought the banking crisis to a head were basically reinvented in another guise. And the problem is banks are always in reinventing their product, and state regulation continues to fail to keep up with those things. So we do need to, again, have perhaps more regulation that's effective, but also encourages perhaps balanced growth in the economy and bailing out other industries as well.
Absolutely.
Is needed.
And there was an interesting article, just to finish on before we move on to John's article, but there was an interesting part which said that fiscal spending following a recession tends to be quite inefficient in terms of its very short term in its view, and there's not they don't have time as a government to sit down maybe and think, well, what is actually the priority for our economy and the long term priority for our economy. It, you know, I liken it to a school going into special measures from Ofsted. You know, they are really looking at, okay, how can we build that back up, that school back up over 6 months? But actually it's really a case of you know this is an opportunity, I think, when there is a recession and you are going to decide to spend as a government, that you need to look long term. And maybe we've been quite short term in how, you know, we spent over the periods, and that's what meant that fiscal policy and expansionary fiscal policy has gone a little bit out of fashion as a result of it. And I think even now, you know, since Boris Johnson's come in, I just think he's just sort of turned around and started throwing money at things. And same with Donald Trump, you know, they're just throwing money at things without really thinking about, you know, where we're getting this money from and at where we actually need to prioritise it.
Well, that's a very curious point that you raise, because yesterday I was teaching with my Year 12 class, and we were talking about the idea of fiscal policy and the idea of budget deficits or budget surpluses, etc. And we were saying what's preferable for the economy. And then we were also starting to talk about whether realistically we should have a deficit or not. And naturally, the topic of austerity came up, and whether we do need austerity overall. And this was a discussion that we had within class. And some of them sort of said, well, the government are tackling the deficit, and it's, you know, it's coming down as a proportion of GDP that we're seeing, that they're spending less and that's more under control. They were very surprised when I put the UK debt clock on the board as to the cumulative effect of the national debt. And actually this was rising, I think, off the top of my head, but £5,170 per second at 2.2 trillion. Now, the question is, what are we spending that money on, and does it go back to this idea of effective spending? Is the deficit under control, and are we just being told, well, it's slowing down and government's borrowing less, but actually what's happening is it's basically still rising, but just a little bit more slowly. But what we're being told as individuals is somewhat confusing.
So yeah, we're going to carry on with Market Fraud, aren't we, in terms of your article. So John, do you want to just give a little bit of an overview of your article? And so we, just to let you know, we produce a Leaving Economist, which is a collection of student work, but we also submit some articles from external economists and ourselves, and John's written an article on market failure and some of the modern day market failures.
So I was quite keen to write something that wasn't potentially political, and I tried to sort of open my mind to writing something that was about today's modern economy, and I sort of posed some questions about whether certain things potentially could be an example of market failure. So is inequality an example of market failure? That was one thing I tried to tackle within the article. And although it may not be totally, fully, completely related, there are question marks about the way in which maybe the market has suppressed wages, and through the creation of use of capital equipment has pushed more and more workers into accepting lower and lower wages, which they can't survive in today's world. And then maybe because they haven't got those high wages, we then have inequality, and then other issues come up like poor healthcare, poor diet, etc. So this was one that I raised through the article. I also talk about the idea very much of modern day externalities. I had a fantastic holiday and I went to Berlin, and what was very impressive in the city was the fact that there were so many modern day new forms of transport, bikes and e-scooters. There were five companies offering e-scooters, and likewise Mobike and Lime for both bikes and scooter, etc. And I thought, this is great, you know, we're trying to promote sort of environmentally friendly travel around the city, which, you know, we could argue is a massive merit plus for any economy and market, and, you know, we're looking at merit goods and positive externalities. But what was actually more interesting was the negative externalities that had then followed as a result of these products. You know, what's happening is that they're being dumped all over the city in, you know, all sorts of places. There's no docking stations. There were people who'd embraced the cycling revolution, but they had no helmets on, etc. And I started to think about the idea that actually we've got new markets, but there are new risks associated [S2] Absolutely. [S1] With those markets opening up. The article then goes further to talk about sort of the idea of the evolution potentially of things like the media, and how the media has created markets for things like sport. And whilst that is something that might be a growth sector, it's having impacts elsewhere. So whilst I'm not a great cricket fan, I do see that the damage that the creation of a market is having, because people can't afford to pay for Sky Sports, so things like cricket is not growing as a sport. So is this a negative externality because boys won't be, or girls won't be involved in that team sport going forward because they're not getting exposure to it? Does pay TV markets also create the idea of behaviour of our sports stars? I'm a great Puritan of football, but we see people like Wayne Rooney many years ago, and behaviour on the football field, which is being emulated in small scale games, which you could argue is a negative externality created by that market, a byproduct. The tattoos that these players wear, while some people might think they're a great merit, personally, not for me, negative externality. And, you know, is this creating an expectation in a society that actually we potentially are seeing sort of a change because of a new market opening up? What was very, very interesting when I wrote the article was the fact that how common technology was as a theme in many of these new externalities that I'm identifying. Technology is creating the opportunity, but the state is failing to keep up to speed with that new technology and the need to regulate it. So for example, Lime was growing with scooters and bikes and Mobike, etc. They were all providing these things. Technology makes it easy just to get the product onto the market. The government can't keep up to speed with how to regulate that and make sure docking stations work and the public behave in a certain way. Technology is behind this, and the government is lagging behind massively in what it's doing.
Absolutely. And I think it's really interesting for us as teachers and as students to think about externalities like this, because it's too easy to just look at the textbook examples like smoking, you know, dropping litter, anything to do with that harm, you know, emissions and harm to the environment. They are textbook, you know, market failures. But actually, in nearly every action or every market, there is always going to be some external cost of some form. And it's a bit of just a cost benefit analysis, isn't it?
Like, very much so. And I sort of spent some time whilst on holiday thinking about this, but also sort of analysing the things I did. So when we came back, I purchased a takeaway meal. And, you know, whilst I enjoy my food, and we all do, you know, it was wrapped in as much plastic as possible, and I just disposed of it in the bin because I was actually given no opportunity to recycle. You know, these are modern-day externalities, and it's not being dealt with. The number of plastics in the sea, single-use plastics, is significant. And realistically, are we doing enough to reduce and make sure people have got alternatives to these markets overall, or they're doing less damage overall as well?
Absolutely. So when all your students are going down to McDonald's and Morley's, just have a think about the negative externalities you're creating.
Quite shocking.
Have you heard of Morley's, John?
I have been. I've been to Morley's. A doctor, Siddhi, a friend of mine, and we used to eat Morley's before we went to our football game. So, big way forward.
Right, just the last section. Well, not the last section. The penultimate section that we want to just try in every show, just have a little bit of an overview of the UK economy and see how it's performing. So just to give you a quick overview. Inflation came out. I think report came out a few days ago with it at a lower expected rate of 1.7%. So economists did predict it would come out be about 1.9%. So it's below what their predictions were. The good thing is that wage growth is at 3.8%. So actually, in real terms, we are becoming better off. But it does raise questions for the Bank of England, who were thinking about obviously raising interest rates, or have been thinking about raising interest rates, that, you know, this suddenly for them means that they're going to probably put this on hold for a while. The Bank of England themselves have openly said, they've come out and, you know, said that they are very concerned about Brexit and the implications that it will have. The problem is they've got no room to manoeuvre in terms of their interest rates. A question I just want to ask John, you know, do you think we missed an opportunity to like normalise interest rates to get them? And what I mean by that is to move them up to their trend rate, let's say, of, you know, 2-4%. I thought maybe there was an opportunity, not after the crisis, but maybe in the mid-teens, so sort of the 2013-14-15, you know, could we have normalised and been a bit more aggressive during that time?
I think so. I think we could have really tried a little bit harder. I think that perhaps the comfort zone of maintaining rates for quite a long time, 0.5%, and supporting that with some QE, lingered somewhat.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at the US did try to normalise its rates. It's moved a lot higher than elsewhere, and we've seen that going on. I would say that it was an opportunity to do so. That opportunity has been lost now because we've perhaps pushed ourselves into sort of the Brexit chaos and not knowing which way we're heading. They do seem a little bit reticent to change again at the moment, but I think that's because they want to know where we're heading as well.
Yep.
As well, we're looking. I think personally the only way for interest rates at the moment is down.
Yep.
But there isn't much wriggle room.
Exactly.
Going forward.
The good thing to come out of that then is that we only have one option, and that's expansionary fiscal policy, and hopefully that really will mean the end of austerity, and it's now an opportunity for us to but I think be a bit more aggressive with our spending, given that they can borrow at such low rates. I appreciate, you know, we still find ourselves in quite a lot of debt, but, you know, it's the payback on it, you know, the repayment rates are very low as things stand. The other issue is that with inflation inflation is probably not going to fall any further, and following Brexit is likely to rise. I would that we would all predict that to happen. Growth is going to slow down, and then you're facing with a bit of an issue. And what do you do with interest rates? You know, you've got low levels of growth, high levels of inflation. Which one do you prioritise? So there's going to be some big questions following you know, over the next few years as to what the Bank of England actually does, because they're a bit stuck in the middle, and they'd probably like inflation to come down as much as possible so that they don't get stuck with this decision that they have to make. And then the other thing on the back of low interest rates, I read something in Project Syndicate, which I would all really encourage you to read. an article which, John, you'd be really interested in. So the idea of the article was that they said that low interest rates actually stifle growth. So the general theory in economics is low interest rates encourage firms to invest. Firms invest, become more productive, and we grow that way. Now, this article said that low interest rates benefit the dominant firm in the market. So low interest rates will encourage, when a firm has already got a lead in the market, an advantage in the market, they will make the most of that opportunity over a firm that is a little bit further behind, because they can basically increase that gap. They've got the opportunity to increase that gap further. So it's actually your market leaders will be the ones that try and borrow and invest, and they will end up increasing that gap. Now, what happens to the firms behind that then? They end up basically believing that they lose motivation. They feel they can never get to the top. They decide to not invest at all. Borrowing actually, stays very normal despite the low interest rates, and markets become uncompetitive overall, and productivity ends up falling, which I thought was a really interesting way of looking at things. And, you know, a good point of evaluation. I know it's quite a difficult one to explain, but a great point of evaluation to look at, the impact of low interest rates and why it's not always good for an economy.
Maybe therefore that goes back to sort of role of the government as well, that we've got to maybe nudge some of these other firms to move forward, maybe through helping them or basically providing them with some incentive to invest.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think that if we want to stop that in terms of favouring some and not others, we've got to make sure that everyone sees the real benefits of investment going forward.
Exactly. Because when you look, when you think about it, the bigger firm benefits from lower interest rate because they are more credible to lend to. Yeah. My question is, should banks be regulated, maybe asked to offer better rates for smaller firms to give them the opportunity to catch up and become more competitive in that market, and actually do the opposite of what's happening?
It comes down to that age-old question: should there be more, involvement from having state investment banks, that the state is actually prioritising where money's going and to help companies with these things, and also guaranteeing loans? I think it really, really is important.
Absolutely. And then in terms of, unemployment, the figures are very strong at the moment, but I just wanted to touch upon growth. We are likely to miss the first two quarters of growth being negative and actually miss out on a recession. It's fascinating to see where we are at, and I think it's bypassed us, given that everything is going on in Brexit, that we have had the worst start to a calendar year since the months following the financial crisis, which is crazy. Our economy really isn't in a good place. I appreciate employment figures are very strong.
But what I will add to that is that if we look at that, and it may just contradict that view, I personally believe that there are troubles ahead, and I think that we are in trouble now. But if you were Mr. Johnson heading into an election, you would be sitting there thinking, well, okay, let's unpick this. Economic growth, well, it didn't look particularly good in quarter two, but growth has rebounded in quarter three. I avoided a recession. Growth is powering ahead. Unemployment, I've got pretty much full employment, and I can say to people, well, actually, our policies and our ability with employment has been fabulous. We've got virtually everybody who wants a job in work. Inflation is about around target. We've got a weak pound, which is helping to promote exports. If you were looking at the economic data on the surface, you would think, well, this economy is in a decent shape. But I think realistically, we are seeing businesses in trouble. We are seeing a lack of investment occurring. We are seeing the need maybe for a fiscal stimulus coming. I think that the economic data doesn't necessarily tell us the real truth of what's going on in the UK economy. The housing market is slowing up.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're seeing other things happening, and it's sort of
it's not as rosy, but I'm absolutely sure in an election coming forward that the big headlines will be the economy is in a decent shape.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other concern is, you know, it's not just us doing badly, that there are a lot of other, you know, big developed economies out there that are also struggling. And if you just had to look at the outlook at the moment, you know, it's not looking great, you know, before even a Brexit date has been reached as well. So, you know, I think that it's been all a bit bypassed and I think overlooked at the moment, and we haven't been aware of what's going on in the UK economy over the last few months because of everything that's going on politically. But actually, you know, I think the people need to know really that their economy, you know, our economy, sorry, is not in a good place at the moment.
No, and we see the global economy. We see the sort of trade war between the US and China happening. We see Brexit in our world. We see Brexit probably having implications for the EU. We see slowing in the EU, ECB of just lowered rates again. We see this happening. You know, the world economy is not in a good shape, and we see also problems more recently with sort of oil supply and question marks, which underpin sort of those economies as well. So yeah, there are issues brewing and maybe heading on a downward trajectory.
Absolutely. So the last thing we're going to do is what we call the good, the bad and the ugly. We're just going to pick out one thing each, you know, that we think has been good about the last few months, one thing that's been bad and one thing that is ugly. So, John, do you want to start off with your good and I'll give you my good for that?
Okay, so my good, I'm fascinated by the Brexit debate. And what I'm actually very pleased about is that the Brexit debate is one that divides people from top to bottom. It really does. But what I'm actually pleased about is the fact that we're now seeing shifts within our political framework, with voters having choices. So whether you're a Brexiteer, there's now the Brexit Party for you. We've got another party, the Liberal Democrats, campaigning to cancel Article 50 and to stay in the EU. We're seeing Labour to some degree being clear on its position. I'm not saying totally clear, but it's being clear on its position. But we're actually starting to see that happening. And we're also seeing political activism. We're seeing people getting involved and stating their points of view. And that's from all walks of life. And I think that's important. If we are going to have honest discussions about things, we want people to engage in the process, and I think that's good. We're now seeing a direction of different political choices, and we're now seeing people involved, getting more involved in the debate more than ever. And I think that can only lead to hopefully a better society if that energy can be harnessed.
Great. I've just picked out a few things. I think the first one for me is Kristalina Georgieva's EU nomination to replace Christine Lagarde at the IMF. It's fantastic to see another female economist in a top position on the international level. I think the climate protest today, we're recording it on Friday, the 20th of September, great to see. We've got an inset day at school. I hope a lot of the students are out there protesting and supporting our futures. We would love to be, I think as teachers. And then finally, I think a good thing to come out of the UK economy is the wage growth situation. We've got pay rises, teachers, which is excellent. But for everyone out there, you know, in real terms, we are, for over the last few months and maybe the last few quarters, we have finally seen some good, strong progress in terms of us becoming better off as workers. What about the bad then for you, John? What's been bad? Save your ugly to the end, though.
What's been bad? I think I spent some time thinking about bad. I will go back to the Brexit debate. I'm going to go for the bad. Basically, we see clearly whether we are going to get an Article 50 extension, and a law has been passed in Parliament to say that if nothing has been done by the 19th of October, We see clearly that has occurred, and people like the Prime Minister saying very clearly he will ignore or potentially will ignore the law. And I think that that's not good in a democracy. It's particularly bad. We want democracy to work. There's been laws passed through Parliament for a reason, whether you believe that or not. But we can't have somebody just saying very clearly, I'm going to ignore that on behalf of the majority in Parliament. I find that an outstanding position.
I'm actually going to go outside of the UK for our bad, and to an economy I think is, well, I think it is struggling at the moment, and that's Germany. It is actually going through quite a tough period, despite its trade surplus being, you know, huge, and being very, very unbalanced. But I think it's going to find the next few years and the next decade actually quite challenging, in that it hasn't, I don't think it's modernised in as much as it could have, and it's going to maybe face a difficult period in terms of automation, the rise of technology. It's very much an economy that, you know, works with, has human input to production, and really protects workers against the automation process. Those that went to our trip in Frankfurt, I appreciate there was two very different factories we went into, one with 97% automation, one with 97% workers. But I just think, the other thing I saw was 3D printing, and then the impact that's going to have on things like the car industry.
Yes.
And, you know, will they be able to just print cars going forward, and how are a lot of these car manufacturers going to react to that? They are written into their constitution that they can't really run a budget deficit. The ECB interest rates as low as they, you know, can possibly be. They really are going to have to move towards some form of tax cuts, I think, if they want to stimulate the economy or to spend some money. So my bad, through no fault of their own, because they've had, a fantastic
years of growth.
20 or 30 years, of amazing growth. And being one of the leading nations in Europe, without a doubt. But there's talk of, France sort of taking over from them as the lead within the Euro or the European Union, but the model that they have just maybe just needs a little bit of modernising.
Just to
reflect what, the progress that technology has made.
And then maybe also because there's also sort of, again, the resistance to change quite a lot, and there's also a coalition government in Germany, which again may have kind of lacked sort of change and direction from happening for quite a long time as well.
Absolutely. And then the ugly for you, John?
Ugly has to be the closure of Parliament. And I know I've done three related purely to Brexit, but the closure of Parliament. I think, if we're going to close our Parliament, we can't have that. We're at such a critical junction, not only with Brexit. We need that debate to happen. If people want to have peace with the sort of outcome of that, wherever we're heading, we need to have Parliament open, and we can't have basically Parliament being closed at such a critical time. And it may not just be for Brexit, and Brexit is something that is on everybody's mind, but there is so many other things that need sorting.
Absolutely.
In the UK, and we need to pass legislation on a whole range of different areas. And discussion and debate needs to happen. And what we're seeing is that closure for political gain, etc. We can't, this is just ugly politics of all. And again, you see that, and I'm pleased that people have gone out and sort of made fuss about it and have gone out and protested, which I think is good. And it's people from both sides of the divide to some degree. But I really do think that if we're going to be regarded as the mother of all democracies, and our parliament is held up worldwide, we can't have it just being closed because somebody says, well, actually, I want to shut down debate for 5 weeks. I know there are party conferences happening in that time. We can't, we can't have this. And it's not just about Brexit, it's about so many other things that need discussing, and those things need to happen through the House. And if you look at the Parliament channel, you know, people wanting to file petitions on behalf of you know, their constituents of things that have happened, missing the deadline because they can't, there's not enough debating time. And they're on small issues that which really do affect people's lives. I'm not saying that they're more important than the big issues, but very clearly this is just totally, totally ugly politics of the highest order from a personal nature.
And then my ugly is probably the other side of John's good, and that's that it's great to see people engaged, but I do think there's been a bit of a rise in sort of hate politics over, I'd say, probably the last few years. And I'm quite active on Twitter and reading Twitter, and I just feel the amount of childish comments that I see from MPs and against one another. I just feel that we need to have, you know, the freedom to state our views on things, you know, whether you know, if this other person, you know, whether this these views are completely polarized and they are completely opposite end of the spectrum, we you know, we need to respect other people's views on issues out there. And I think that's really important that we respect their views. You know, obviously we can offer a counter argument, but their views aren't them as a person. We sort of depersonalize it a little bit. And I just think, we, you know, at the end of the day, some of these people, the things that they are saying, and if they do believe it, that's absolutely fine. You know, there is a human behind this, and some of the, you know, the tweets I've seen, it just frustrates me. From MPs that I have a lot of respect for as well.
What I don't particularly like on this issue is somebody who might be an MP goes onto Twitter, puts their point across about something, whatever their viewpoint is, and then never returns to the fray to either enter into the debate or the discussion. Mm. I think that it's very much they might have a particular view which they want to hammer out to promote oneself or to say this won't be an issue, etc., but they never ever return to the view. So then what you get are extreme viewpoints and people who aren't necessarily leading the debate attacking one another as well.
And I just feel we made such progress as a society in terms of you know, being more equal, you know, our acceptance of different races, different religions, different sexes. And this is one area where I just feel that actually discrimination is probably a little bit on the rise, if anything, and we are now discriminating against people because of the viewpoint that they have on a certain issue. And whether or not we believe it, I just still think we should allow people to have the freedom to say what they wish, but also be mindful of, you know, how they counter that argument and the language that they use, and particularly the role models. Like, the MPs are role models. They're just like sports players are for sports fans. They need to be role modeling good behaviour. And I just feel sometimes on Twitter, you know, we can't have people like David Lammy, big supporter of him, but, you know, throwing comments at Donald Trump, and same with Sadiq Khan. You know, at the end of the day, the UK has to build a relationship with the US. That's the phone going. John's going to pick it up and just put it back down, and we'll just ignore it. But that's the end of our podcast anyway. The Dismal Science first episode was good fun.
Enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll be back for a second edition. Okay,
enjoy. Take care.
Bye.